From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You have to love somebody whose first drop was called The Prequel. He was letting us know that we were going to be hearing a lot from him. And I think this man is somebody who has an interesting idea of the way that Black culture and mainstream pop culture intersect. One of my favorite things of his is a song he did, Land Speeder. We'll talk about all those things, but more importantly, we're going to talk about his feature film directorial writing debut. That's a mouthful. So is the title, The Harder They Fall. My guest is James Samuel. James, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. And the fact that you reference Land Speeder shows that you are a G.O.D. That's one of my favorite joints, if I may say so myself.
One of mine, too. And, you know, there's this interesting thing you do. You can sort of, you like to massage while the influences and the original pieces come through. I wonder how far back this goes from you, because it seems like you're always doing this mosaic of contemporary culture and Black culture and mainstream culture. Is that where you sort of begin as an artist, as a musician and a director?
It's interesting. As a musician, I've always regarded myself as a, at root, a folk musician, right? Like my voice and my acoustic guitar. So at root, like my influences musically go back further than time itself. And just the way I grew up, if I'm outside the house, I'm listening to Wu-Tang Clan and Mobb Deep and Jay-Z and Nas. But if I'm inside the house, I'm listening to Crosby, Stills and Nash, Joni Mitchell, Jackson Brown, you know. So my brain kind of is always cooking everything together in both film and music, and drawing from all of my influences and kind of like bringing them into the present.
Yeah, but I feel like this thing that you do, you just referenced Joni Mitchell and Jackson Brown, but also Mobb Deep and Jay, and you connected to people who use music for storytelling, which we hear a lot of in folk as well, don't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely. For me, I've always said like Joni Mitchell for me is the closest thing to Jay-Z and vice versa. Joni Mitchell, on the Court and Spark album, she has a song called Down to You. She describes a one-night stand by saying, go down to the pickup station craving warmth and beauty. You settle for less than fascination. A few drinks later, you're not so choosy. When the closing lights strip off the shadows of the strange new flesh you found, clutching the night to you like a fig leaf, you hurry to the blackness and a blankness and a blanket to lay down an impression of your loneliness. I get the same feeling from that as I do listening to Jay-Z's You Don't Know What You Mean to Me from The Blueprint. I'm from the streets where the hood is swallowing me, bullets are following me. Like, it's the same, for me, it's the same type of thing, which is why when I create and I write music and I produce for artists, I try to bring those worlds together, like putting Charlotte Gainsbourg on the same track as Jay-Z and Jay Electronica. And I called it Dinner at Tiffany's. Like, I'm always like, you know, this, it's film, it's music, it's just art and really just expression and just being true to who I am as an artist and not trying to kind of pigeonhole myself into any kind of barrier.
No, just hearing you talk about this makes me think of Don Juan's Reckless Daughter, where it's Joni with Jaco Pastorius and those jazz roots of hers kind of bleeding through. But that same kind of almost kind of proto hip hop thing you're talking about that she's doing, because the words just kind of come streaming out of her. You can feel what that groove does to
exactly.
her. And you could call yourself a folky kind of, but I can still hear that groove. I mean, I almost think of the stuff like, you know, that old Joan Armour trading joint Opportunity, where you get the backbeat, the count is as important as the lyric.
Wicked. Absolutely, man. Absolutely. And that's why it's interesting that we're speaking about Joni and Don Juan's Reckless Daughter. And you know, when she was doing that album and all her Mingus influences and stuff, she was getting like, she wasn't getting praised. You know, she was trying to push the boundaries as much as possible. And a lot of people wouldn't understand it. And for me, what I love about her in particular is that she's really groovy. The Hissing of Summer Lawns, dun, 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 has such a groove to it. And I think if we listen to a lot of folk, there'll be groove to it. It might not be made with an MPC, but there'll be like sneaky grooves in there, even rhythmically in the words, right? Like Court and Spark, love came to my door with a sleeping road and madman's soul. He thought for sure I'd seen him. It's a like a crazy type beat in and of itself. And I tried to incorporate, you know, just growing up being black from the hood. And I tried to, like, you know, bring all those things together again, which is why I was literally taken aback when you mentioned Landspeeder. Because it's a cross. It's like it's something I called an indie banger. It's a cross between both indie type music and just a banger of a song.
By the way, it's a treatment. We're talking about music with my guest, writer-director James Samuel, whose feature debut on Netflix is The Harder They Fall. I guess we should talk about that eventually. But the reason I brought that up was when the first time we talked, and I mentioned, you know, we talked for a long time about They Die by Dawn, because for me, everything you do exists as part of a continuum. And I couldn't hear Landspeeder and not really hear about the way you think musically about making a movie and how the soundscape, which also takes us back to Sergio Leone and the Morricone collaboration, where sound was as important as the visuals. And I guess we should talk a little bit, if I can get you to let audiences know what The Harder They Fall is before we start talking about more influences here.
Yeah, The Harder They Fall is a Western. It's a revenge tale. It's a tale about revenge, about a child that has his parents killed in front of him when he was a child. And he grows up. He becomes a gunslinger and grows up hunting the man that mysteriously killed his parents. But for me, really, it's a love story. It's a love story rooted in the cycle of violence that we find ourselves all too often in. You know, really, you become what you kill, right? For me, everything is about love and loss. And that's what the movie at its root is about. What's different and unique about the film is that most of the characters are black, and they're all real characters that really existed in that space and time in the Old West. And just characters that we've never learned about. We've learned about Jesse James and Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett and all of these people, but we've never learned about Stagecoach Mary, Bass Reeves, and Rufus Buck. So I kind of put them all in one fictional tale, all of these real characters in one fictional tale and one space and time. It's kind of awesome.
No, it's awesome. It's not kind of awesome. But when we met, I asked you why you chose the name Nat Love, because that's a really specific kind of thing. And it shows this man is also known by another name, more famously known as Deadwood Dick. And I asked you why you chose that name for him. And you gave me a really interesting reason for that.
Yeah. His whole ethos, right? His whole life was about losing everything that he loved, right? His parents, that's all he knew. And he's driven. Everything he does is actually driven by love. The irony is that his name in real life was Nat Love. His nickname was Deadwood Dick. Deadwood Dick has a much different feel to it than Nat Love. And the ending speaks to what happens to Nat Love and what he will become without giving away any spoilers, but what he will eventually become when he meets his destination. So everything about him is love and the loss of it. So the fact that his name in real life was Nat Love, it was something that I had to go with.
Yeah, but I was just really taken with that because you're really using that to set a tone. But we were talking too, and I was telling you how much I was taken with the sort of prequel, if I can say that here, They Die by Dawn, which is really about psychological violence. It's not nearly, you talked about this, with not nearly as much violence or shooting in it. Or I shouldn't say violence as much, I should say brutality, because the violence is visited in a way to not just be about an act of violence, but an act with a consequence. In the short version, They Die by Dawn, which I hope people get a chance to see, there's a lot of tension that's built throughout the entire thing. We're waiting for violent acts to happen. And if you can talk about what you did in The Harder They Fall, that's really kind of the 180 of that.
As you said in They Die by, and I love that you said that, brother, in They Die by Dawn, everything is like dialogue and the anticipation of violence. As you said, it's still brutality, but it's more mental brutality. You know who these men are, or you learn who they are, and you learn what they're capable of. But it's much more mental than anything else. Whereas in The Harder They Fall, the switch is flipped, and you really see it from the beginning. I show you the actual brutality that this child experiences, and everything he does. Just growing up and everything that happens around them. I didn't want to leave anything on the table. There's a lot I still leave to the imagination, but just with regards to the violence, I wanted to actually take you into that place, into that time, and kind of show you, attempt to make you feel what they were feeling and what the child felt as a, you know, seeing his parents ripped away from him. I really wanted to hit people over the head with it. And now that I have your attention, watch this story.
I guess I think of it as being a story about, you know, old school, almost Old Testament vengeance. And you were very specific. And I want to talk to you about this because, like I said, every act of violence that we see is met with a response. I feel like that's your way of sort of saying there has to be responsibility in these acts of violence, and also the way people of color visit acts of violence upon themselves, and this circle that it stays in. I mean, that's, by the end, the real horror is that people of color shooting each other. I mean, and that's the kind of impact that had to be psychological, or rather intentional for you, that you wanted us to see that, you know, as much bravura and invention as you use to do this, is there's an awfulness to this too, isn't there?
Absolutely. This is the absolute awfulness to it. And as you said, every act is met with immediate repercussions, even if you don't see the repercussions with bullets. Like when they take out the Crimson Hood gang in the beginning, the immediate repercussion is the return of Rufus Buck. Like the violence leads you nowhere but toward a destination of more violence. There's no happy ending at the end of violence. Someone's always gonna lose. And in the end, that energy comes back to you. And I really wanted to focus on the carnage that happens within our own communities, even, and just within the environments of which we grow up, and really take a look at, without preaching, right? But take a look at what we're actually doing it for. You know, for the most part, you're seeking vengeance against someone that was seeking vengeance. Like, what is the root reason for this? And is there another possible way? Again, without preaching, but the character Cherokee Bill that Lakeith Stanfield plays is literally always saying he repudiates violence. And so I'm not necessarily giving the answer, but just shining the light, just putting some kind of commentary on it.
Well, no, I think there's so much that goes on in this movie because this is so energetic and it's so well laid out and the performances are so much fun and you use the entire canvas. There is so much in this that's subtextual. And I was wondering, if we go back, is this probably a 10-year gap between They Die by Dawn when you start to make it and The Harder They Fall. And I just wonder if that sort of time between the two made you think, well, no, you want to sort of make that tension that's so visual and so much a part of They Die by Dawn, make that kind of a subtextual thing. So you have to be paying attention. See, these are Black people killing each other. And there's that they're pitting themselves against that. And then they're talking and not communicating. I mean, that to me is kind of the horror too. It's almost in some ways like the old West Coast, East Coast wars, that people are talking and not hearing each other.
You know, it's a really interesting thing. You know, the way I tried to turn everything on its head with this film. If you look at it, like when we get to the end and we find out, you know, things about Rufus Buck and what he did, then when you look at what the Rufus Buck gang, the quote-unquote bad guys, Idris Elba, Regina King, Lakeith Stanfield playing Rufus Buck, Trudy Smith and Cherokee Bill, when you look at what they're doing through the movie, they have an objective and an outcome. They just have a menacing way of going about it, just like the government, really. And they're actually not bad. Whereas when we meet the Nat Love gang, they're taking out people in cold blood. Like, you can actually call them baddies. What I wanted to do is really study, not necessarily the characters, but almost study ourselves and why we call particular people bad guys and particular people good guys, and when everyone really is doing the same thing, because everyone's kind of like outlaws in the film, in this fictional tale. But if you look at it from one aspect, it's almost like an hourglass. At the end of that movie, tip the hourglass upside down and watch the sand spill out from the other direction. And you'll see that there's an argument to say that the Nat Love gang are bad guys and the Rufus Buck gang are good guys. But obviously, sins of the past come back to haunt you. So just with regards to how we deem what's bad and what's badder, so to speak, I always want to study, and I try to study that with this movie.
We'll take a break. My guest is James Samuel, whose directorial debut on Netflix. And if you're lucky, a few theaters near you is the film The Harder They Fall. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is The Bullis. Don't think of him that way. Call him James Samuel. His writing directorial debut on Netflix is The Harder They Fall. And we were talking during the break. Interesting thing that happens in Black culture, where Black cultures always celebrate the West. And I was thinking about, you know, Kool Moe Dee and Wild Wild West. But then that going back to the Jamaican posses, because rap comes from toasting, and the Jamaican posses were in their toasting, we're always referencing the West with Regulate and Bust the Cap and that kind of lingo that's now thought of as being hip-hop lingo that comes from the Old West. And those Jamaican musicians were influenced by the Westerns themselves, specifically in the way you were by the Westerns of Sergio Leone. And it's got to be funny to you when so many people say, well, this is amazing you're bringing this stuff up. And some part of you must be thinking, Black culture has always celebrated the Western.
Absolutely. Like it's like you said, Kool Moe Dee and Wild Wild West. The Wild Wild West, or Marley Marl and Symphony. Remember that music video? Dun, 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 dun. And it was just a cowboy. Everyone was cowboys. And then we go back to the early days of dub with the artists like Josie Wales or Eek Mouse doing an album called Black Cowboy, or Pinchas doing Bandolero. And Black culture has always, always celebrated the West. And a lot of dub music was influenced heavily by what Ennio Morricone was doing with Sergio Leone, which is why I utilize dub and stuff as like the foundation of the score in The Harder They Fall, because it just works perfectly. I bring back Barrington Levy doing Stilly-ally-ally-ally-ally, which I've always heard my whole life, always visualized galloping over it. If Hooves Galloping had a melodic signature, it would be Barrington Levy going, "See, here I come," which is why I incorporate all of those things in The Harder They Fall, and it's for me seamless. It's almost like a rite of passage. Like these things deserve to go together. These two art forms deserve to be married.
Well, see, that's to me what's so much fun about it and so exciting about it is that these things that feel to other people like anachronistic or like you're strictly speaking quoting posse, that's not entirely true. I mean, certainly you do quote Mario Van Peebles' posse in the film, but by making that connection to contemporary culture and the West, you're saluting the way that Black culture has always paid attention to Westerns, because Black culture is innately a part of the Western. You know, at one point it was an insult to be called a cowboy. A white man was called a cow puncher. But, you know, that doesn't sound as melodious as being called a cowboy. So it's all about appropriation and making a stand and drawing a line in the sand, isn't it?
Absolutely. Cowboys was a term for Black people and Mexicans. It wasn't even a term for the white people. And then Hollywood, they took it right back. We'll have that and erased everyone of color from the picture and from the narrative. As far as like Black people, they were always a huge part of the cowboy experience. It wasn't even the Old West. Not one person lived in the Old West. It was the New West. It was the new frontier, the new America. There was nothing old about it at the time. And a huge part of that was people of color and Black people in particular. It's just Hollywood gave us a really narrow viewpoint of what that experience was about. They made women subservient and people of color treated less than human. So we never got to learn that till much later.
Well, I mean, the way you grew up, though, made this story an ideal way for you to express all your love of all culture. Like I said, for me, so much of what you do, and that's why I started by talking about Landspeeder, is about the way Black culture intersects with mainstream culture and takes ownership of a place in it. Black culture is so often ignored. And I guess I want to hear about the way you grew up. We can hear all these points of intersection in the music of The Bullis. And then in visual terms, we could see it all in certainly the videos you've done, but specifically, they Die by Dawn. And did you go to movies a lot as a kid with your parents and siblings? What was that like for you?
I was always, Elvis, addicted to film, right? I always loved film more than anything else. I suppose around 11 years old, I got a really deep introduction to film because I was transferred. Well, I was kicked out of one school and I was joining another. So if I was kicked out of school around February, I had to join the new school in September. All of my family was off. My brother was working that time, and my big brother and my other siblings were at school. So I was just at home with my mum. And my mum is a cinephile. She is a diehard film buff. And she just sat me at home watching all of these films and TV shows. They were always on television. She taught me about Alfred Hitchcock, taught me about Fellini, taught me about Francois Truffaut, taught me about David Lean, who's her favorite director. She just taught me all of this stuff. I do not even understand how she knew so much about film. She never studied it. She was just addicted to cinema. And she's, really taught me about these directors and sat me down, made me watch all of these films. So by the time I joined my second school, I was literally addicted to everything cinema. And then, that was me at 11 and 12. And after then, I would make sure I'd go to the movies every week and I'd go with my mum, with my brothers and sisters and digest as much as possible.
I have to tell you, James, it's hard for me, especially seeing that movie in a theater, to not connect it to you as a musician. I feel like the world works for you almost primarily through sound and through words, and the way stories are told through words or not told, or can be told in silence. The spoken word to me seems like, and music, the count, seems to me to be crucial to the way you think. And it's interesting to hear you talk about yourself primarily as a filmmaker.
Well, Elvis, it's like I see music and I hear film, right? I've always seen music as a visual art form, not just a sonic one. And it's like I hear films, so they join in my head as one thing. But I suppose the thing, what I loved about film, my mum brought me a Super 8 camera when I was like 7, and she bought me a Bolex 16mm when I was 13. I was always playing instruments because there was instruments in the house, right? I always had a guitar in my hands. And so I was always shooting short films and putting music underneath them, like composing the music to it. I was always doing both. They were never really separate for me. But I suppose I learned so much about film at an early age. It got me addicted to like writing and making stuff and getting people in the hood and directing short films and then just doing music to it. So I never actually got a job. I just have an occupation. I just never stopped doing what it was I was doing anyway and kind of like joining the both forms together. It just makes it James. It's just basically who I am as an artist.
The music you've been talking about and those producers in the music are the kind of producers who, in real ways, and the best producers of music are function as directors anyway. And you must have found as you were making music doing that, that it kind of connected you naturally to the way you worked as a filmmaker, being at the center of things and telling the story you wanted to tell.
Making music and working with orchestras and a bunch of different musicians, and the more you expand there, it's the equivalent of directing. It's the same thing. It's the same communication process. When you're working with a singer, a vocalist, it's exactly the same kind of process as working with an actor. Your fellow artists need feedback and need to be secure in the fact that you know where you're taking everyone. They need to be secure in the fact that as a filmmaker or as a producer, you know your vision. So therefore, they can just trust you and just collaborate.
It's a treat. We're talking to musician and writer-director James Samuel, whose debut as director-writer is The Harder They Fall. Talk to me about that title.
The title is, for me, awesome homage to the Jamaican Jimmy Cliff, The Harder They Come. Remember, the sure as the sun will shine, because the harder they come, the harder they fall. That's what I know. And in the beginning of that movie, they're watching in the story, in the beginning of The Harder They Come, they're watching the Western, right? The Western they're actually watching is the Franco Nero Django. And then it kind of influences the whole story. For me, The Harder They Fall is the Western they would have been watching in The Harder They Come had they had The Harder They Fall at the time. You know what I mean? It's like The Harder They Come, The Harder They Fall. And also, it's like, it's so ambiguous, but so on the nose with regards to what happens in this movie. The harder they fall.
Because they Die by Dawn could be a 30s film noir title. And clearly, just knowing your work, titles are really important to you. They feel as much a part of the text as the storytelling itself.
Elvis, let me show you how much of a G you are. The only person that's ever said that. They Die by Dawn is my riff on the film noir, They Live by Night.
How
deep is that? Yeah. That's why they live by night, they die by dawn. The harder they come, the harder they fall. You know what I mean? That's so deep. You're the only person that has ever, ever said that. The only person, it's a Nicholas Ray film with Farley Granger, if I remember rightly. And it's just like a dope, dope film. Kathy O'Connell, like it's just a dope film. They live by night. I was like, they live by night, they die by dawn. That is so, so crazy that you said that.
Well, I just hope we this recorded. But you must have connected immediately to Jay-Z, because he loves movies. He loves comics and graphic novels. He loves all these things. And he brings things, all these things together in a way similar to the way you work, doesn't he?
Yeah. From his first album, he, you know, was referencing like Al Pacino's Carlito's Way, and everything Jay does always has a cinematic element to it. And he's really, as you said, he's a consummate storyteller, and he's a deep, cinephile. Like, people would think that our collaborative language is rooted in music, but it's not. Like, a lot of what we share, I mean, it's always music and always film, but a lot of what we share is about film. It's about the more cinematic aspects of art than the musical aspects. And you know, collaborating with Jay is like breathing. He's a really, really like insightful human being. And where has a special skill is he can jump into any character's head and get into their psyche of why they'll do that or why they won't draw a gun, because of his own experience. So, you know, growing up at the time he grew up in Brooklyn, that was like the Wild West itself. So he'll talk about why a person would draw a gun and why a person wouldn't draw a gun, why they'll fire, why they won't, and where the fear sets in and stuff. And it was really good picking his brain in that regard as well.
Well, I bet. Well, clearly there's a ton of stuff we can talk about, but we're out of time. So, James, thanks for doing the show. Thank you so much.
Elvis, man, firstly, I'm a fan of this station, and you know, I, like anyone else, I'm always tuning in wherever I can and catching whatever I can on YouTube. But also, just thank you, Elvis, man, because you see exactly where I'm coming from, and you articulate my thought process better than me. So thank you, brother.
Well, I'm going to go off and blush. Our production staff includes Katie Gilchrist. Thank you, Katie. John Meek, Paul Smith, and Desmond Taylor. The show is edited and produced by Rebecca Mooney. I'm blushing. To better days, everybody. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.